And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing conversations with a wide range of people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and we are honoured today to have as our special guests in the studio, Kathy and Ralph Kelly. Kathy and Ralph have written a book titled Too Soon, Too Late, which tells how their family life was changed forever in a split second of random violence 7 years ago, and what they have done since to help others in making our community safer. Kathy and Ralph, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Kathy and Ralph, your book starts with an account of the senseless death of your eldest child, Thomas, at the hands of a stranger in King's Cross, Sydney. You now know more than you ever expected or wanted to know, I'm sure, about the courts and hospitals. But why was the killer charged with manslaughter and not murder?
So in the process, if I can explain the process to you first, because sure. It is quite interesting, is obviously the DPP handled the matter on behalf of the Crown and the people of New South Wales. And what they do is the DPP confers with the family and the homicide division and ask if they want to hold the case at murder, if the charge is murder, which in our son's case it was the charge, and if we're prepared to drop it to manslaughter. So they ask the family and the homicide division, and then the DPP make a decision. The decision that they made was to drop it to manslaughter because it was seen that it didn't fit the criteria of murder, although we believe it did fit all three criteria. It was certainly against our wishes, and I understand it was also against homicide's wishes as well, that the charge be held at murder. And we were since told that out of the 63 Crown prosecutors, overwhelmingly 38 said that they would have held it at murder, the charge at murder, and put it through the courts as murder. The offender went out that night to hurt somebody, and he even said later in the night after he'd hit Thomas, I really want to hurt someone tonight. So certainly he was on the rampage and going out to cause trouble, and that resulted in a death. And we've had other friends who've lost children to being shot and killed, and in this one particular case the father said to me, it was the bullet that killed my son, and in your case it was the punch that killed your son, so really what is the difference?
So that decision was not in your hands as to whether it was manslaughter or murder. It was out of your control.
This is how we feel. It may not be true from the DPP's perspective that there's a lot of money involved. To go to the Supreme Court, it's $20,000 a day. The case can last 3 to 4 weeks, whereas if they get a plea for manslaughter, it fast-tracks that. We're in court for probably 4 hours. And the DPP, our Crown prosecutor, had told us in a meeting prior to the court that we should expect between 0 and 4 years. I asked him to fight that because I felt, Thomas was 18. His life was taken from him. The offender was 18 as well. But what we quickly learned, it was all about the offender's life and not about Thomas. Thomas's life was taken and was now meaningless to the system. And when you walk into the Supreme Court, you go there with that hope that, Tom and other people have gone before us and after us, that your interests are going to be looked after. But it's really not the case in the end. And one of the very first meetings that we went to was with a homicide and a representative from the DPP's office. The homicide division were the first people to speak. There were 25 families in the room who'd lost loved ones to murder. There's about approximately 120 murders a year in New South Wales. And the first thing that they told us is that 90% of you in the room won't see any form of justice. And you have to understand that the trial will take at least 2 years. The process takes at least 2 years minimum. And if you go through this process thinking that you won't get justice, then you'll survive because the majority are very, the complete opposite to what your expectation is.
It's horrible to think that there's money behind even a decision like this. But Kathy, you say in your book that you are not victims, you are survivors. But then again, you say there are two Kathys. And I'm not sure which Kathy we've got this morning, but I think we've got the one who's coping well.
Look, I think I'm basically the same person, but the reason I said there was two Kathys is because when you're out and about on a daily basis, you can't just be sobbing or or feeling sorry for yourself, or thinking about, you know, what's happened to your family, you have to put on a happy face, I suppose, and you do that with the closest people around you as well, because you don't want them to be feeling that, oh, I don't want to see her, you know, all she talks about is this or that. So, you know, there's that person, but then there's the person at home that has a little cry every day, every time I see a photo of the boys in the house. It either makes me smile or it makes me sad. And Ralph was in the bathroom this morning having a shower, and there was a nice Elton John song playing, and I was making the bed, and a few little tears. Everything that's, you know, that's soft and gentle, you know, makes you think of the boys and what we've lost.
Yeah, and as you say, probably when you least expect it, you can have those sad feelings come upon you. But yeah, we've got to carry on, I guess. So I'm just wondering too, what was the reason behind the title for the book, Too Soon, Too Late?
Well, Ralph actually came up with the title, and the boys obviously lost their lives too soon, and all the changes that we've been able to bring in, and the good that we're trying to do is too late for our family, but hopefully there's hope for others.
And you've described the purpose of the book. I think there are a few main ones. You talk about wanting to touch people, you want to raise awareness, and then there's the personal side as to why you wrote the book. Has it had a cathartic effect on you?
It was a much more difficult process than I think either of us anticipated it was going to be. We held back on the original release on the book because there's still an investigation going through with the coroner's office, and so because of that, we held off. So it was a very long, drawn out process. But in some ways, it was a little bit cathartic for me. From my perspective, I wanted the story to be told from our voice, on the basis that there's, you know, the media sometimes gets it right and sometimes they get it wrong, and there's been a lot of misquotes and misinformation out there. So it was just nice to have our words down, but also to be able to acknowledge all the people that have come into our lives, in not necessarily individuals as such. We tried not to do that because we thought that we might miss somebody, but really to acknowledge all the people that have been there to support us through the process, and to inform people so that at the end of the day, once they'd read the book, they could make their own choice, their own decision as to whether or not they would like to get involved in community and help create the social changes that we think we really need in this country.
Now, Ralph, perhaps you could tell us a bit about your background, but you were born in England and you went through the dreaded English boarding school system.
I did.
I didn't, no. I'm born and bred here. So right. What are some of your memories from that boarding school environment?
Oh, look, I've got good memories and bad. You know, I was at boarding school from the age of 7. My dad went when he was 4. And it was the system, really. You know, we had fagging, which is the English system of doing things for senior boys. We were, I'll use the term, brutally beaten by the headmaster with canes and leather straps and anything he could get his hand on. And, you know, basically it was almost every other day. And it led to a stutter, and I couldn't speak particularly well at all. So I tried to go under the radar in classes so that I was never chosen to speak out in the classroom. And then worse than that, when we had school assemblies every morning, they'd choose someone to read the lesson. And I did everything in my power to get out of that, but sometimes I couldn't. And that was very difficult for me when you have a stutter, to be chosen to stand in front of 200 or 300 of your fellow colleagues. And I look back and I think they should never have done that. They should have actually said, look, you know, we understand that you've developed this and you shouldn't do it, but you get through it. All of us in that school learnt to pull down the hatches and not show emotion. That was the only means of survival. So we weren't bullied. There was no bullying in the school because the school was the bully. The administration was the bully. But it was pretty difficult. You know, in the English winter, we had one sheet. There was no heating in our dormitories. And I remember lying in bed and in an embryo position trying to keep warm. And then they'd get us up in the morning and we'd snout outside. We'd have a cold shower. If you didn't stand under the shower for 30 seconds, you'd been there for 2 minutes. All of those things, which was meant to make you a man. And it probably did in many ways, but it also emotionally, it affected you, I think, and for the rest of your life in terms of your behaviour.
And you vowed at some stage never to send your children to a boarding school. It must have been a shock for you when Thomas and Stuart both said that they wanted to go to a boarding school.
Yeah, look, I think it was different. Well, Tom, who was really quite introvert and, you know, not in the family sense, but when he was in public or at school, he's a little bit like me, I suppose, from that perspective. We had the kids at school in Barrel in the Southern Highlands, and Tom came to us one day and said, I'm not getting the subjects that I want to do. I'd like to go to the King's School at Parramatta and have more choice in the subjects that I can choose from. And that was a shock for both of us, for Kathy and I, and we did talk about it. And I said, you know, it would probably be okay for Thomas because it will teach him a sense of purpose and how to get on in life and from a social perspective. And for Stuart, he was very different to Tom in terms of he was, you know, extrovert and he fitted in well with everybody. And so it was much easier for Stuart in boarding school. He went from year seven, but Tom struggled in boarding school for the 2 years that he was there. Undoubtedly, he struggled. He was bullied, you know, quite a lot. But he refused, you know, he showed resilience. He refused to change houses. He refused to leave the school. And he just dug in. And at the end of his days, as we were driving out, he said, you know, I'm going to really miss this. And I think year 12 was much better for him. Boys mature and they don't bully as much. Following that, he went to university at night. He was studying commerce at Macquarie at night. And boys who he would have stayed clear of, he was walking into a lecture theatre one night and the boy said, hey, Tom, come up and sit with us. And I said, how did that go, Thomas? You know, what did you do? And he said, look, I went and sat with them and it was all good. We've become friends now. So I think we see that bullying happening in schools. But when boys do mature, it falls away in year 12 and definitely after they leave school.
Yes, that's another topic that we could spend a lot of time talking about. But yes, both your boys have been subject to bullying. Like a lot of these things, you don't see the consequences sometimes when you get involved. This ripple effect too that followed Thomas. So would you put the direct result as what happened to Stuart back to what happened to Thomas?
I think absolutely. I would say that without a doubt, if Thomas hadn't have been murdered, I believe that Stuart would be here today.
Because there is this widespread knowledge in the community. I mean, most people, if you said, do you remember Thomas? I've just spoken to various people lately and everyone remembers that day. It's sort of like a similar event in people's lives. And there is that wide community empathy, I think. Because, I mean, we all realise it could happen to any of us. Is that the message that you want to get out?
Yeah, I think it can happen to anyone. And initially when we were asked by the New South Wales Police to go to their headquarters to do an interview the day after Thomas's life support was removed, you know, I think we were initially quite confused, and we say that in the book, why people took such an interest in our case or in the story. And I think that they could see you know, a family there begging for somebody in the community to come forward, because not that anybody deserves to die at the hands of another person, but, you know, there are, I suppose, young people that do engage in risky behaviour the way that they might behave with their violence and getting involved in fights. But Thomas wasn't that kind of boy. And we're not just saying that because, you know, we think our kids are better than other kids. He just was brought up differently, and he had a good sense of wanting to go out and just have a nice time and enjoy the company of this girl that he'd recently, you know, fallen for at work.
And was that really his first girlfriend, the one he was meeting?
Absolutely.
That night?
Absolutely. He hadn't. It's funny because with the boys, they were quite different as young boys, as Ralph said, but I think towards the end of both their lives, both being 18 and a half, Stuart had become a lot more like Thomas, probably from the experiences that he'd had. But with Tom, you know, I remember when he first went to high school, it was a co-ed school in the Southern Highlands, and he was always coming home talking about this girl and that girl, and, you know, I think he really wanted a girlfriend. And when Stuart, on the other hand, was in primary school, you know, he had such a vivacious personality that everybody liked him, including girls that weren't even at his school. And I think he could have had a girlfriend, you know, as early as year six or year seven, if that was even really a girlfriend, but he couldn't care less about them. Going through high school, it was, you know, along the lines of, you know, I don't really have time. I've just got to, I want to do well, and then I'll worry about that when I finish school. So, you know, the night that Thomas went out, I would hardly even call her a girlfriend, because there'd been some flirting at work, and you know, that was going to be the telltale sign that night, whether or not she reciprocated his feelings. So
in those years since, I notice that you say you've been through those five stages of grieving, the denial, the anger, the bargaining, the depression, and finally the acceptance. But you say you've been through it more than once. So it's not something you go through those five stages and then everything's fine. I think you're saying that you go through it periodically, do you?
I don't think you ever get over it, if that's the term that sometimes people use. Mm. You know, you should be at that point where you've moved on or whatever. You never really move on from losing someone that you love, especially a child. And I think having, you know, we were at a point, I think I was at a point when, just before Stuart took his life, that we were starting to laugh a little bit more in the house, and there was a little bit more everyday things going on. And you know, I guess we certainly hadn't got over Thomas's loss, but we were in a slightly better place. You do go through different stages and at different times from each other. But having then lost Stuart, it just threw us back into that turmoil again. And it's never really been the same. Mm. You know, losing a child to suicide is probably one of the most terrific ways to lose someone that you love.
I think you sum it up by saying that time helps, but it doesn't. You don't say time heals, so it's always there.
I think time does heal a little bit, but whether you say help or heal, it does make things a little better, but it's always below the surface of your skin. You know, it doesn't take much. It can just be, you know, a simple argument, or it can be kicking your toe, or it can be anything that just makes you feel really upset. And those thoughts, when you're upset, always relate back to the boys.
Now, Ralph, you threw yourself into the foundation work not long after, when you stirred yourself up to get moving, and strangely enough, you then became something of a target in some areas of the community. But in fact, you're not wowsers, and you're not even teetotalers, as I understand it. So is it just a misapprehension of what you were trying to do?
I think it was a misunderstanding driven by some people in the community to attack us, and also the Premier at the time, Mike Baird, and Professor Goodenfull, they're from St Vincent's Hospital and the two casinos. So literally they were doing everything they possibly could, which revolved around the lockout laws. But we operate three safe spaces in the city on Friday and Saturday nights for the last 4 years, actually. So we have one in King's Cross, one at Town Hall, and one in Darling Harbour. And in those 4 years, we've helped over 67,000 people get home safely. And we work with the Liquor Accords. There's about four or five Liquor Accords that we work with within that area. We work with the Australian Hotel Association. We work for the clubs and pubs. I've personally met with the largest clubs up at King's Cross. And I believe from a very early start in the foundation that we needed to work with everybody, because we need to all be on the same side to find a solution to violence in our city, which I guess when I first started looking at the foundation, I was shocked by the amount of violence since when I was 18. So one of the first meetings I had was with the New South Wales Police Commissioner at the time, Andrew Scipione. And Andrew said to me, "Ralph, I have a budget of $3.2 billion a year. I've got the third largest police force in the Western world, and 70% of my resource is tied up on violence, both domestic and non-domestic." And that shocked me, I have to say. I was just really shocked. He then went on to say, "Look, I can't change this. Only community can change values, not the police force." And I think that was one of the key moments, one of the driving moments that we decided to start the foundation and try to make a difference. And, you know, you only have to speak to Gordian from St Vincent's to understand the carnage that they would see in emergency on the weekends. The night that Thomas was killed, and every weekend they would have two neurologists on duty every weekend on Friday and Saturday nights. Those neurologists are no longer there. They're on call. And, you know, the saving to the hospital, you can probably measure it well over $100 million in savings to the community in people who haven't been attacked.
That work for the foundation, doing such worthy work, you mentioned at one stage very candidly that there have even been stresses on your marriage as a result of all this. Did that help keep you together, giving you both a purpose?
Look, I'm not sure it did, Bill. I'm just trying to think of words to say this that is articulate. It hasn't been easy. I mean, we share the common grief of losing two boys, two children, obviously. I think the purpose for me was the foundation. And I think that you find, you know, lots of not-for-profits or charities that start due to something awful happening to that family. And, you know, when I meet people who have charities, I ask them why they started them. And, you know, often it's that, well, every time there's a reason. And I think we fill a void that the government, and in this case the City of Sydney, should be providing the services that we provide and making changes. And it gave me purpose. It probably kept me alive, to be honest with you. But for Kathy, that was different. I was just driven. I was working 18, 20 hours a day on the foundation. Changes to the laws in terms of the sentencing laws in New South Wales, having been through the courts. You know, we ended up in the High Court. It was a three-year process. And working with the Attorney General to make changes to those laws after our cases had gone through the court system, and then working to make the city a safer place. For Kathy, I think it was different. Her purpose was different, so I should let her explain.
No, I have absolute admiration for everything that Ralph's been able to achieve. And, you know, there have been fantastic people supporting him along the way, but I would say without any question, you know, he has done a lot of this, you know, single-handedly, with that support, but single-handedly had the purpose to do what he's done. Originally, I was really... Not quite as passionate as he was about what he was doing, but when it was all coming together, I was, you know, I was really proud, and I'm sure the boys are very proud. I just think it's been such a long time now. I'm finding I struggle a little bit because I just want to get to a point in my life where we can think about and remember the boys for just who they were, rather than thinking about the alcohol-fueled violent attack on Thomas, the fact that Stuart took his life, you know, the subject of murder and suicide. And I think until we're at a place where we're away from that, and that doesn't mean the foundation can't go on and be go from strength to strength, and I really do hope that it does, but it's more about, for me, I always wanted to be a mum. Sometimes I'm not a very good one, but I to me it's all about family and what we've got left, and I just want to focus on that now. So you know, particularly Madeline, the opportunity to live a personal and professional life without seeing Thomas Kelly's name, her brother's names, all the time. So, yeah, that was the reason behind that.
We're speaking today with Kathy and Ralph Kelly, and about they've got a new book called Too Soon, Too Late, which we reached the stage of the program where we ask our guests if they'd like to select a song. I think, Ralph, you've chosen a song. Would you like to tell us why about that song?
The song we selected is called It's Quiet Uptown, which was one of the main songs in a stage production called Hamilton, which is showing in Broadway and in London and comes to Australia in 2021. And it kind of replicates a lot of our feelings about unimaginable, you know, tragedy in your life. And Alexander Hamilton, which is who the show is based on, lost a son in a duel, talks about moving uptown to where it's quiet. You know, he's going grey, and I think Kathy and I have definitely, well, Kathy, you can't tell, but you can with me. Well, I've gone grey certainly over the last 5 years, just wanting to get away and lead a quiet life. And I think, you know, we're both getting on. I just turned 60 recently. And, you know, where does it end, I suppose? I ask myself that, but I'm still really determined with the foundation to make a change and a difference. And I think we can. But I also do know that there has to come a time where it is quiet uptown.
That the words don't reach. There is suffering too terrible to name. You hold your child as tight as you can and push away the unimaginable. The moments when you're in so deep, it feels easier to just swim down. The Hamiltons move uptown and learn to live with the unimaginable.
I spend hours in the garden. I walk alone to the store, and it's quiet uptown. I never liked the quiet before. I take the children to church on Sunday, a sign of the cross at the door, and I pray. That never used to happen before.
If you see him in the street, walking by himself, talking to himself, have pity.
Philip, you will. would like it uptown. It's quiet uptown.
He is working through the unimaginable.
His hair has gone gray. He passes every day. They say he walks the length of the city.
You knock me out, I fall apart.
Can you imagine?
Look at where we are. Look at where we started. I know I don't deserve you, Eliza, but hear me out. That would be enough if I could spare his life. If I could trade his life for mine, he'd be standing here right now, and you would smile. And that would be enough.
And that was It's Quiet Uptown by Lin-Manuel Miranda, Renee Elise Goldsberry and Philippa Sue from the soundtrack of the 2015 Broadway musical Hamilton. It just remains for me now to give a special thank you to our guests, Ralph and Kathy Kelly, and to if people want to get involved with the foundation or with the safe spaces, is there somewhere they can get information on that?
Sure. So as Kathy said, we've changed the foundation name to Stay Kind, which is around kindness. And the reason why we've done that, I've explained it really briefly. So we looked into, well, what makes people kind, if they have empathy, those other values, but the underpinning value was always kindness. So our foundation's always been about values. It hasn't been about coward punches or about suicide. It's about changing community values for the better. What people can do is we're having in July, which was where we are now today, is we're having a month of kindness, which we've called Kind July. And we would like people to get up every morning and be kind to one another. Literally understand that people need to observe other people. They need to help other people if they need help. Be non-judgmental when they do provide that help. So what we're asking Australians to do is go to our website, which is staykind.org, and make a pledge of kindness that you are going to be kind. And it's also good for your own health, because if you are kind and you help someone, then you will feel good as well. But to bring back that, you know, we can say to police when we go past them in the street, you know, thank you, you're doing a great job. To, you know, paramedics, you know, heavens above, you know, people are now being violent towards paramedics and staff in hospitals, and to actually say to these people, you know, thank you, you know, what you're doing as first responders is so important, and we really want to thank you.
Well, we might finish up on those words, but don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email. We'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And if any issues have been raised that cause you concern in this program, please call Lifeline on 131114. We'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.